The Iran ceasefire has redrawn the map of West Asian geopolitics overnight. To understand what it means for Iran, for Israel, for the US, and for the global order, we're joined by Syed Mohammad Marandi, a political analyst and a professor at the University of Tehran. But before we get into it, let's pause for a moment. Because if you believe Washington, the US has just won a historic war over Iran. So let's see. Regime change didn't happen. Strait of Hormuz, control still with Iran. Uranium stockpiles still with the Iranians, and sanctions partly lifted. Donald Trump calls it a victory. We've heard this joke before, and I'm sorry to say that it's back. It took the United States 20 years in Afghanistan to replace Taliban with the Taliban. It appears it took 6 weeks in Iran to replace Khamenei with a Khamenei. So the question we're putting to Syed Mohammad Marandi today is simple. What was this war actually worth? Just before the 8 p.m. EST deadline and threats of wiping off a whole civilization, a ceasefire has been agreed upon. Who do you think really won the war, who lost, and what does the big picture here really tell us?
It's quite clear that the Islamic Republic of Iran has won, because Trump initially demanded Iranian capitulation. Then he backed down, and ultimately he presented a 15-point plan, and Iran rejected that. And then Iran presented its own plan a few days ago, and the United States has now accepted that that would be the framework for discussion. So the United States has gained nothing, and the Iranians are in firm control of the Strait of Hormuz, and Iranian armed forces are prepared to continue this war if the United States tries to deceive us and to use this as an opportunity to rearm and regroup.
The ceasefire is being celebrated in the United States, in Iran, across the world. But would you say that the ceasefire and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz is very fragile, very shaky at the moment?
Oh, without a doubt. It is very shaky. This is, of course, a crisis that Netanyahu and Trump imposed on the world. We did not start this war. At every stage, they escalated and then we responded. So the economic crisis that is evolving across the world is the doing of Trump and the Zionist regime. But we want business, trade, transaction to be normal. This was not something that we wanted. It's something that they imposed. And unfortunately, we could go back to where we were just hours ago very easily. So far, this is a major achievement. Trump has been forced to accept Iran's framework for negotiations. And everyone can see what the framework is. But right now, there is a spoiler, and that is Netanyahu, because Netanyahu is not abiding by the ceasefire. The ceasefire is very clear. It includes Lebanon. As long as Netanyahu is murdering the Lebanese, that means that the commitments given by the United States are not being fulfilled, and that means that we could have a continuation of the crisis.
In the last 6 weeks or so, we've seen so much death, destruction, displacement, even countries outside of the region, especially in the global south, bearing the brunt of the war due to fuel, energy shortages. So what was actually achieved from this war?
I think this is a far, far greater defeat than anything the United States has experienced for decades. It cannot really be compared to anything else. The United States failed to take a single square meter of Iranian territory. And the United States failed to force Iran to shift its position on any foreign policy issue whatsoever. And the war that this Zionist regime and Trump carried out has led to Iran changing its policy and taking control of the Strait of Hormuz. So it is a catastrophic defeat for the United States. But we have to remember, this is not over. Netanyahu and the Zionists are great spoilers, and they would like to see the war continue. And basically, what Netanyahu and his allies want is the global economic crisis to continue.
Let's contrast Trump's warnings, threats, abuses, F words, his constant posts that were very, very abusive, some of the words that I wouldn't even want to say on TV, and Iran's response. The embassies across the world, some would say very, very savvy, very savage responses. Where does Iran get this calm, this very, very composed demeanor from, if you could tell us?
Our sin is that we want to be independent and that we support oppressed people under the thumb of empire, whether it's in Cuba or Venezuela or South Africa under apartheid, and now, of course, Palestine. Our sin is that we oppose ethno-supremacism and the subjugation of the Palestinian people. And so we see our cause as being right. And therefore, there is no reason for us to be outraged, to insult and abuse. And those who insult and abuse us, it's because they have neither logic nor morality.
The US outspends Iran and massively on defense, but Iran never looked subdued. Iran never looked rattled. Why? And how really did that happen? Because the perception usually is that if US is coming onto a country with all its military might, the country's had it. But that wasn't the case with Iran.
I think it's quite clear that the contrary to Western propaganda that we've been hearing for 47 years, the state and the population are one. The state is comprised of ordinary Iranians. The leadership in Iran is comprised of ordinary Iranians. That's why we saw for weeks people on the streets across the country defending the armed forces, defending the leadership. And I think it's quite clear that the other side did not have that support, neither at home nor abroad. So that strengthened the will of the armed forces. And also, I think that since Iran's independence, true independence, 47 years ago after the revolution, the decisions in Iran were made in Iran. And therefore, Iran's defense policy was also made in Iran. Iran decided instead of importing Western hardware or just purchasing military hardware from abroad to rely on its own youth and to develop its own defense capabilities and its own defense doctrine. Thus, the underground missile bases, the underground drone bases, the underground factories. And this ingenuity, alongside the popular will in Iran, led Iran to victory.
What does the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz really mean? It's been choked for several weeks now, and we've seen the kind of impact and the damage that it's caused. Will the energy flows be back to normal very soon then?
That is what we want. We did not start this. We were doing business as usual until this imposed war by the Trump and Netanyahu regimes took place.
But we'll have to see, because Netanyahu is violating
The ceasefire agreement. And I think that he seeks to wreck it and thus prevent the world from going back to normal.
After the death of Ayatollah Khamenei, many said that Iran will bend or will have to bend, but that did not happen. Is Iran's grip on the Strait of Hormuz its most powerful pressure point?
One was the ability to strike the Israeli regime 24 hours a day. And one was the ability of Iran to strike U.S. targets in those countries which hosted and host U.S. bases and are complicit in this war. And of course, Iran's ability to control
The Strait of Hormuz.
and the Persian Gulf.
Everything that the US President Donald Trump wanted, a regime change, uranium, Strait of Hormuz, the Kharg Island, none of that actually happened. So, what did Donald Trump achieve out of this war?
The only thing that Trump and Netanyahu achieved is creating global hardship. That's all. They achieved nothing but creating harm to the entire world economy and to expose themselves as reckless and completely selfish and not taking into consideration the needs of people across Asia, across Africa, across Latin America, and even in the West.
From Barack Obama to Trump to Joe Biden to Trump again, US policy, it swings. How can Iran, or anyone for that matter, trust a country that keeps rewriting the rules?
Iran will not trust the United States, and this war is not over. This is a ceasefire. And we'll have to see what the Americans do at the negotiating table. And we'll have to see if Netanyahu and the Zionist regime are able to wreck the ceasefire. That is exactly what they want to happen. I have no doubt that the Zionist lobby and the Israeli regime will do whatever they can to make sure this war reignites. We saw the resignation letter of one of the highest ranking intelligence officers in the United States, appointed by Trump. In that resignation letter, he said Iran was not a threat, Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, and the reason why we have this war is because of the Zionist lobby in the United States and the Israeli regime. So those same factors still exist today, and therefore, we should not be too optimistic. This regime will do whatever it can to reignite war and to make the global crisis far worse than what it is now.
There are talks about Iran trading in yuan or rial. Could this mark a deeper shift in global financial power? The very fact that dollar then automatically gets bypassed.
We are sanctioned by the United States. They don't want us to use their dollar. So we would prefer ourselves to use other currencies.
Yuan, rial. What do you think we can see in the way forward?
Yes, or the rupee or anything. I'm not involved in the decision-making process, but the North-South corridor between Iran and Russia, of course, is very important for trade with India. So I don't know what the final decision will be or what is being done as we speak. But alternative currencies, whether it's the Iranian currency, the Indian currency, the Russian or Chinese currency, I'm sure that all of those are open for discussion. But the Americans shouldn't complain that we don't use the US dollar. They don't want us to use the US dollar.
The Gulf states, how do you describe their role in this war? Were they mediators, hedgers, flashpoints, silent stakeholders? Do you think that much of the Muslim world, it let Iran down, given the fact that despite religion coming to play, it was essentially Beijing and Moscow that were seen to be Iran's biggest allies?
This is not simply about religion. This is about right and wrong. The Iranians have always defended The Cuban people, it's a communist country. The Iranians have always defended the Venezuelan people. It's a Catholic country. The Iranians defended the peace of the people of South Africa under apartheid. It's not a Muslim country. And Iran has always shown great respect for the resistance in India and Gandhi for their liberation over the British Empire. This is an issue of right and wrong. And the countries in the Persian Gulf that hosted US bases and facilitated attacks on Iran have Iranian blood on their hands. They are complicit in this war. And they betrayed their own people, they betrayed the people of the region, and they have to pay compensation.
I think it's safe to say that the rules-based international order is collapsing in front of our eyes. What shape, what new shape then would the world take moving forward?
Well, the West created that rules-based order and then they wrecked it themselves. And I think that countries like Iran, India, Russia, China, among others, have to think about this and find an order which is just, because the law of the jungle doesn't serve the interests of anyone except a few people in Washington and Tel Aviv.
Thank you very much, Professor Morandi, for your time. Our next guest is one of India's most distinguished diplomats, a man who has spent decades at the heart of New Delhi's engagement with West Asia. Ambassador Sanjeev Arora, welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Yeah, thank you, Runjan.
You've been for a very long time New Delhi's negotiating voice for West Asia, the region. You've served in Lebanon and Qatar and many other countries as well.
Yeah, in Saudi Arabia as a young diplomat long, but during the Gulf War, actually long back.
How important is it for India to diversify its energy import options beyond West Asia?
The diversification of energy policy, it's an ongoing process. Naturally, we are now the world's most populous country, a fast developing country, and our energy requirements are huge. So that would continue. But as things stand today, like the rest of the world, we have been adversely affected. We have worked out, I think it is based on our very time-tested friendly relations with the state of Iran. I think Iranians have taken a very astute and long-term view, and some of our supplies, some of our energy shipments have been allowed. But it poses a major challenge. So diversification would continue.
What role should domestic production play then?
Domestic production is already playing a role. And you have, of course, the ongoing initiatives at exploration.
Are they enough?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think our dependence on fossil fuels, if I may say, oil and gas, if you, in overall terms, is to the extent of almost two-thirds or more of our requirements. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you just one example. Qatar, where I served as India's ambassador for long.
You're the longest serving ambassador
yes,
to Qatar.
Yes, it was from 2012 up to 2016. If we look at our global import of LNG, 65 to 70% has been from Qatar, who now unfortunately have been very badly affected, you see, because when Israel hit the South Pars gas facility of Iran, then in retaliation, the attacks that were carried out by Iran.
Yeah.
One of those was a strike at Ras Laffan gas refinery, which is the world's largest gas processing and refining facility.
Russia's first deputy prime minister recently visited India. He has offered more oil and gas to India amidst the crisis. How do you read these developments? Is it a friend in need, is a friend indeed kind of situation?
Russia is a time-tested strategic partner for India. We have a multidimensional, very close, very strategic partnership with Russia, including in the area of energy, right? Well, in the overall scheme of things, our total import of oil, it's mainly oil from Russia, was very small, right? And then during the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict, the quantities started increasing, I would say surging. If I recall correctly, I think it touched at least, I think, more than 50% or nearly 60% of our global imports of oil, you see, notwithstanding the sanctions imposed by the United States.
Once again, it's hit an all-time high, by the way, the Russian imports.
It was expected. So I think what the first deputy prime minister of Russia has stated during his visit to Delhi, it's simply a reaffirmation of that close partnership, right? And our official position, very rightly so, always has been that, look, when it comes to sanctions, I mean, we don't go by U.S. sanctions.
Yeah.
Well, United Nations Security Council sanctions, that is another matter. But if you look at the ground realities, yes, in before this epic fury operation was launched by U.S. and Israel against Iran, you know, our imports of oil from Russia were showing a declining graph,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the irony of the situation is that the president of the U.S. himself said that, yes, because he realizes, after all, this is a major global energy challenge, a major global economic crisis, right? So looking at the rising price of crude oil, you know, with Brent hitting as high as $115 or $118 per barrel and so on. So he allowed, I shouldn't use the word allowed, I mean, he sort of relaxed the sanctions. And actually, ironically, you see, with all their very, very strident sanction regime against Iran, now the same U.S. in the wake of the war has no problem with Iran supplying to other countries. And you know that in our case, for a long period, actually, it is the largest shipment from Iran that we have received during this war, after many years.
Many Asian countries are facing severe energy shortages. Do you think it's unfair that it's the global south that often bears the brunt of the conflicts, the wars that are started by the West?
That is very unfortunately the consequence of the global order being highly iniquitous. Where is the reform of the UN? Where is the expansion of the UN Security Council?
No voice.
And right now, I think the type of discourse that we have in the international arena, I mean, even to talk of what I just mentioned, I think most people would say, come on, are you crazy? They would laugh at it. They would scoff at it, right? So yes, the global south, you know, I would say from Bangladesh to Brazil, from sub-Saharan Africa to the developing countries in Central Asia, look closer home. I mean, India and the rest of South Asia. Look at developing countries, even much worse, you see, the least developed countries. Look at the small island development states and so on and so forth. So they are the worst sufferers. I mean, the huge energy crisis. There is a very major crisis of fertilizers resulting in an alarming food security situation in various parts of the world. So, and that is where I think leading players, leading voices in the global south have to really do much more. And that, of course, includes India.
Ambassador Sanjeev Arora, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Runjan, for having me on RT India.
Pleasure.